my great pleasure this evening to introduce Peter Billam. Peter's spoken for us before, and he's an extremely knowledgeable music scholar. But he has a really interesting background. His CV makes for extraordinary reading.
It's long reading.
Yeah, that's right. A BMus honours in theoretical physics from Imperial College London. And started a PhD in hydrodynamics.
Magnetic hydrodynamics.
Yes. My husband said, I used to do that.
Yeah.
And then gave it up to play the electric guitar. Made some recordings.
It was fashionable at the time.
Yeah, it was cool at the time.
Yeah.
Then went to Switzerland as a computer programmer.
Yes, basically.
Then gave that up, went back to music.
Yeah, but
did some
forward.
Composing, yeah. Musical director, all that kind of thing. And then came to Hobart in 1983.
Yeah.
Done some lecturing here at the Com in electronic music and composition. And also continued to work as a computer programmer and also a computer systems administrator for various government departments, including, Water and Resources and Treasury, and CSIRO, all those kinds of things. So he's sort of, I won't say led a double life, but it's nearly like that. It's quite extraordinary.
That's fair enough.
So anyway, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Peter tonight to talk to us about music after the war.
Yes.
So please make him very welcome.
Thank you very much. So I have to get... If anyone can't hear, is the mic okay there? I can hear the sound. Okay, good. Okay, I timed the talk and it's fairly tight. I want to leave time for questions at the end because unless you're completely crazy, there will be questions at the end, and so it will be fairly fast. Okay, I apologise in advance. Also, I've been ill for the last few weeks, my voice might give out. Just don't worry about it if it happens. So I was born, baby boomer, I was born in 1948. It's just after the war. So the musical culture that I inherited, it's cracking up already, was from the generation before the war. And that had been an extraordinarily brilliant time. For example, just a couple of years around 1910 gave us Stravinsky's Petrushka and the Rite of Spring and Bartok's Bluebeard's Castle, Debussy's La Mer, Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe, Schoenberg's five orchestral pieces, Busoni's Dr. Faust, Delius, Mass of Life, Scriabin's Prometheus, all the late Mahler symphonies, including the Song of the Earth, Elektra and Salome from Richard Strauss, and those are just the big pieces. You know, there's also the Debussy preludes and all the late Scriabin sonatas and the early Bartok string quartets. A phenomenal outpouring. Just a couple of years. So I grew up listening to that and sort of expecting to live in the world in which that kind of cultural flowering would be the norm. So I remember when I would have been about 9... having just learnt at school that the population of the world was about 10 times what it was in Beethoven's day, I asked my mother, where are the 10 Beethovens then? Of course, she didn't know the answer. And then when I grew up in the late 60s and got to know the composing scene in London, everything was post-Webern serialism, and Darmstadt and Tanglewood and Universal Edition and all the associated competitions, festivals and journals. Schoenberg, Berg and especially Webern were idols, and meter, harmony, melody and theme were deprecated. The old German music publishers like Schott and Peters and Bott and Bock and so on, they continued selling their Schubert and Brahms and so on, but they did not add to their catalogues. Universal Edition produced works, published works by hundreds of young composers who, producing either post-Webern serialist or aleatoric or graphically notated or conceptual works, tried as hard as they could to produce important music. But because of the genre it was being written in, the public didn't take to it, and by and large neither did the performers. There was a serious separation between performance and composition around that time. So it was clear to me that a cultural tradition that had been alive before the war, for example, when Bartok wrote the music for strings, percussion, and celeste in 36, or Richard Strauss wrote Metamorphosen in 46, was alive no longer. What had happened? One left and done three. So before 1944, there was the OWI, the Office of War Information, which, in spite of its name, was a civilian organisation reporting to the State Department. The OWI's job was to run cultural affairs in the Allied occupied countries. Theatre, literature, concerts, magazines, radios, newspapers, and so on. And most of their staff were idealistic, cultured young East Coast graduates. So composers Roy Harris and Mark Blitzstein headed their music division and the ASBIE, the American Broadcasting Station in Europe. But then in 1944, with the invasion of France looming, Eisenhower changed the OWI into the PWD, the Psychological Warfare Division, and gave it greater autonomy from the civilian agencies and more military associations. And then within occupied Germany, a military government was formed. And in August 1945, the PWD and most of its staff were taken over by the ICD, the Information Control Division, reporting to the military government, OMGUS, Office of Military Government, United States, under the command of General Robert McClure. General Robert McClure had authority over 37 newspapers, 6 radio stations, 314 theatres, 642 cinemas, and 237 book publishers. McClure was a warrior. He argued that the ICD's mission was to make the individual German aware that we have waged war against Germany and not just against the Nazis, and of his personal share in the collective German responsibility for the acts of the Nazis and militarists, and to accept Germany's guilt as a nation as his personal guilt. So he set about stripping away German misconceptions about Germany and its relationship with the world. One of the most important of which was the Germans' pride in their musical tradition. Now, Nazi propaganda had promoted German music proudly, that the prominence of German composers had been promoted as evidence of Aryan superiority, and the Nuremberg rallies were choreographed to the music of Beethoven, Bruckner, and Wagner. And the Nazis had run a huge advertising campaign, Pflegt deutsche Hausmusik, or play German chamber music in your home. So obviously General McClure wasn't keen to encourage people to play German chamber music. Furtwängler was blacklisted for 2 years. Not because the Americans were blunderers or cultural illiterates, but because the ICD saw the conductor, as he saw himself, as a preeminent symbol of German musical culture. But whereas Furtwängler cherished that culture as the wellspring of civilization, the ICD considered it to be the birthplace of Nazism. So, however, while Robert McClure and the upper levels of the OMGUS hierarchy wanted an ongoing mopping up operation against German culture, he was undermined by his own staff in the ICD music branch, who felt that their job was to restart German culture so as not to allow the Nazis and Soviets to look like the goodies when the Americans looked like baddies. So there was a bureaucratic civil war between the upper levels of the military government and the music branch. And the fates of German musicians, or European musicians, were determined mostly at random by the this bureaucratic civil war, whose outcomes were made even more random by regional committees controlling the lender and by interaction with similarly random decisions made in the British, French and Russian zones. And this process decided the concert performances of composers like Eck and Hindemith and Orff and Pfitzner and Strauss, and the careers of Julius Patzak and Schwarzkopf and Rosbaud and Munch and Leighton and Krauss, Knappertsbusch, Grindel, Gieseking, Teitchem, Jochum, Scholti, Böhm, Leinsdorf, Kallian, Furtwängler, and the whole generation. Meanwhile, the broader denazification of German society was underway, just like the de-Ba'athification that happened under the Americans when they occupied Iraq. Every German was required to fill in a form, a Fragebogen, detailing how close they were to the Nazi Party. And these forms were compared with each other and with Nazi Party records, and anyone who was a party member or a close associate found themselves permanently unemployed in the post-war era. Now, the ICD was soon overwhelmed by the scale of that task. But Michael Josselson and Nicholas Nabokov, the cousin of Vladimir, the famous novelist, who ended up running the Congress for Cultural Freedom, of which more later, cut their teeth working in the military government offices comparing those forms and making denazification recommendations accordingly. American music, in the eyes of the senior planning officials, was always thought to have a very special role to play in Germany. Especially the State Department authorities saw American culture as the vanguard of democracy and refused to authorize music by non-Americans or even of emigres like Hindemith or Martinu or Krenek, because these composers were not deemed to be sufficiently representative of America to have the necessary re-educational value. So the music branch promoted works by Piston and Harris, Schumann, Thompson, Copland, Barber and Gershwin. Robert McBride's Strawberry Jam Overture went down very badly. Piston's Incredible Flutists and Concertino for Piano and Orchestra also went badly. And several wannabe composers working for the music branch took the opportunity to get their own works performed by the Berlin Philharmonic and the Vienna Philharmonic. And composers like John Bitter, John Evarts, Harrison Kerr, Everett Helm, and also those performances did not convince the German audience that American music had any value. But Menotti's The Old Maid and the Thief, that went okay, and Barber's Adagio was well received. The real hit was Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, which, however, was a double-edged hit because it does portray life in America as harsh and uncivilized, and unforgiving, especially for blacks. This is probably the most important sentence in the whole thing. Although the ICD's music branch tried to get musical culture restarted, they only really had any influence over performance. They had little say in the future of the composing tradition itself. So, what happened to the composing tradition? In 1946, while Germans were still starving amid their ruins and freezing in winter, the military government had already set up the Darmstadt Music School. What I'm saying, it was a very high priority for them. And remember, the military government is run by McClure, who wanted to wipe out the whole tradition. The ICD music branch didn't have any say in that. That's the separation between performance and composing, which we still have. That's where it started. Ongust knew right away that Darmstadt music was unloved. I'll quote an official Ongust report from 1947. It was generally conceded that much of this music was worthless and had better been left unplayed. The overemphasis on 12-tone music was regretted. One critic described the concerts as the triumph of dilettantism. The French students remained aloof from the others. Remained aloof from the others and acted in a snobbish way, and their teacher, Leibowitz, represents and admits as valid only the most radical kind of music and is openly disdainful of any other. And his attitude is aped by his students. It was generally felt that next year's course must follow a different, more Catholic pattern. But that change did not occur. So in August 1947, the music branch had managed to get Fort Wengler cleared, and he was permitted to conduct a benefit concert for Jewish refugees with the American violinist Yehudi Menuhin as soloist. But others higher up the hierarchy were not in favour. The military police checked the papers of everyone coming into the hall. They relented when the concert was already an hour late in starting, and throughout the performance, they moved up and down the aisles, checking all passes and evicting anyone whose papers were not in order. And they also cleared the hall at the end of the music before anyone could applaud. So you see this tension between the music branch and the upper levels. But meanwhile, the Cold War. The American enemy was changing from Germany to Russia. Addressing Congress in March 47 on the situation in Greece, where a communist takeover threatened, President Truman appealed in apocalyptic language for a new age of American intervention. At the present moment in world history, nearly every nation must choose between alternative ways of life, he declared. And this ideological call to arms was immediately enshrined as the Truman Doctrine. On the 5th of June, 47, General George Marshall, the US Army's wartime chief of staff and now Truman's Secretary of State, announced the Marshall Plan to deal with the Great Crisis, warning that the whole world and the way of life we have known is literally in the balance. He called upon the New World to step into the breach with a crash program of financial credits and large-scale material assistance, and thus prevent the collapse into communism of the old world. On the 26th of July, still in 47, a lot happened in 1947, the National Security Act created the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, to coordinate military and diplomatic intelligence and to carry out, wonderful bureaucraties, unspecified services of common concern and such other functions and duties as the National Security Council might direct. Its covert operations wing was called the OPC, the Office of Policy Coordination. Wonderful bureaucraties. And it was made part of the policy planning staff in the State Department. So non-military, it reports to the State Department. Meanwhile, on the other side, in October 1947, Cominform, the Communist Information Bureau, held its first meeting in Belgrade. Formed in Moscow the previous September, Cominform replaced the defunct Comintern. Andrei Tsaganov, architect of Stalin's ruthless cultural policies, told the communists of Western Europe that they had achieved considerable success in conduction work among the intelligentsia. Proof of this is the fact that in these countries, the best people of science, art, and literature belong to the Communist Party and are heading the movement of the progressive struggle and are winning more and more intellectuals to the cause of communism. And in March 1949, Cominform boldly staged a cultural and scientific conference for world peace in the New York Waldorf Astoria. New York, brave move. And it was besieged with right-wing protesters. Nicholas Nabokov, we'll see a picture of Nicholas Nabokov off at the end, attended a panel where Shostakovich was one of the speakers. After a dull session, Nabokov was finally given the floor. On such a date in Pravda, appeared an unsigned article that had all the looks of an editorial. It concerned three Western composers, Paul Hindemith, Arnold Schoenberg, and Igor Stravinsky. In this article, they were branded, all three of them, as obscurantists, decadent bourgeois formalists, and lackeys of imperialist capitalism. The performance of their music should therefore be prohibited in the USSR. Does Mr. Shostakovich personally agree with this official view as printed in Pravda? And provokatskaya, provocation, cried the Russians. And Shostakovich received some whispered instructions from his KGB nurse. And the composer then stood up and was handed a microphone and ashen face turned down to the floorboards. I think there's a video of this on YouTube. I haven't seen it myself. He murmured in Russian, "I fully agree with this official view as printed in Pravda." The rumours that Shostakovich had been ordered to attend the conference by Stalin himself had reached the New York gathering, and any display of independent spirit on his part was a matter of life and death. And Nabokov was throwing punches at a man whose arms were tied behind his back. The Waldorf Astoria conference was a humiliation for its communist backers. This is astute. It was, said one observer, a propagandist's nightmare, a fiasco that proved the last hurrah for the idea that the ideological interests of Stalinist Russia could be grafted onto the progressive traditions of America. And the American Communist Party was now in retreat. Its membership was an all-time low. In fact, it consisted mostly of FBI agents. And its prestige was irrevocably tarnished. And just when claims of a great communist conspiracy began to take their feverish grip, Stalin's strategists had all but turned their back on America and concentrated instead on extending their influence in Europe. The Waldorf Astoria, Berlin. The American reply was a large congress in Berlin in April 1950 called the Congress for Cultural Freedom. Almost anything with the word freedom in it from those years was an American soft power operation. Radio Free Europe and so on, there's hundreds of them. The Congress for Cultural Freedom is a story in itself, but it went a lot better than the Waldorf Astoria. The OPC then made the Congress for Cultural Freedom a permanent institution and gave it the codename PUK Opera, appointed Nabokov and Josselson to run it, we'll see a photo of them later, and moved its headquarters from Berlin to the relative security of Paris. Sorry. The military government, ONGUS, was rapidly downsized and starved of funds, and by 1950 it had been dissolved. But Darmstadt remained. The idol of Darmstadt was Webern. He certainly wasn't chosen for being anti-Nazi. He had written an ecstatic, almost orgasmic letter in rejoicing in Hitler's rise to power. And that letter is quoted in Alex Ross' book, The Rest is Noise. Both the Nazis and the Russians had run fierce... Next slide. Both the Nazis and the Russians had run fierce propaganda campaigns, posters, newspaper, cartoons, and so on, attacking Americans as people with no culture, interested only in money and weapons. So the Congress for Cultural Freedom started a huge campaign to show that Americans could do culture just as well as Europeans, and the art under capitalism has a creative fervour that is suppressed under Nazism or communism. So in cinema, Hollywood produced films like An American in Paris. See this film if you haven't seen it. Politically, it's very interesting. Featuring Gershwin's music and portraying Americans as young, vigorous and scrupulously honourable people who loved Europe and who loved culture and did it superbly, just as well as Europeans, but newer. On April 1952, 1st of April, the Masterpieces of the 20th Century Festival opened in Paris with The Rite of Spring, performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra under Pierre Monteux, who had premiered it 39 years earlier. It was a glittering event with Stravinsky in attendance, flanked by the French president and his wife. And for 30 days, the Congress for Cultural Freedom showered Paris with 100 symphonies, concertos, operas and ballets by over 70 20th century composers. There were 9 orchestras, including the Vienna Philharmonic, the RIAS, the Suisse Romande, the Santa Cecilia, the Nationale Radio Diffusion Française. And topping the bill were those composers who had been banned by Hitler or Stalin, or preferably by both. There were works by Arnold Schoenberg, who had driven out of Germany as racially a Jew and as a composer of decadent music in 1933, and denounced as anti-aesthetic, anti-harmonic, chaotic and inane by Russian music critics, and by Paul Hindemith, another refugee from Nazi Germany, derided by Stalinists for initiating a whole school of graphic, linear, pseudo-counterpoint, which is slavishly followed by so many pseudo-modernists in Europe and America, and Claude Debussy, under whose impressionist tree the fleur du mal of modernism had been allowed to grow, according to Sovetskaya Musica. So also representing the validity of the creative effort of our century were works by Barber, Walton, Mahler, Satie, Bartók, Villa-Lobos, Pizzetti, Rieti, Malipiero, Georges Auric, listed with Darius Milhaud in Sovetskaya Musica as servile teasers of the snobbish bourgeois tastes of a capitalist city, and Honegger, Jean Francais, Sauguet, Poulenc, Aaron Copland. Stravinsky conducted his own Oedipus Rex, for which Jean Cocteau designed the set and the choreography. Even British intelligence was aghast at the scale on which its American counterpart was endowing the cultural Cold War. Malcolm Muggeridge later wrote, "How soon our British setup was overtaken in personnel and zest and scale of operation, and above all in expendable cash. This OSS-CIA network with ramifications all over the world came to outclass our once legendary Secret Service as a sleek Cadillac does an ancient hansom cab." In Cinema Hollywood produced Roman Holiday, 1957. That's right. The next festival Nabokov arranged was his answer to Herbert Reed's criticism of the retrospective nature of the Paris Festival. "Let our next exhibition be then not a complacent look at the past, but a confident look into the future." And at a press conference in New York in February 1953, Nabokov announced, "With that festival, we shut the door of the past. We said, in effect, here are the great works, but they are no longer modern. Even though they originated in the 20th century, they are now a part of history. Now, I have a new plan. We are going to have a composer's contest that is unlike any other competition ever held." The International Conference of 20th Century Music, to be held in Rome in April 54, announced the Congress, this is the crucial event really in the whole Cold War, and from this point of view, announced the Congress commitment to the promotion of avant-garde composition. It was to place the Congress firmly on the map as part of the vanguard in musical experiment, and offered the world a rich example of the kind of music expressly forbidden by Stalin. Money poured in from the Farfield Foundation, through the Farfield Foundation, to endow the competition with prizes totaling 25,000 Swiss francs for the best violin concerto, short symphony, best chamber music for voice and instruments. The press release announced that the festival, designed to prove that art thrives on freedom, was the beneficiary of a generous donation from US gin and yeast heir Julius Fleischmann, who was also brought in to negotiate with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, which agreed to perform the winning composition at its subsidiary, Tanglewood. In fact, by 1953, 8 of the 11 members of the Music Advisory Board of the Congress were associated with the Tanglewood Music School. Nabokov sent the first invitation to his old friend Igor Stravinsky, paying expenses of $5,000 for the maestro, wife and secretary to attend. Stravinsky also chaired the music advisory board for the festival alongside Samuel Barber, Boris Blacher, Benjamin Britten, Carlos Chavez, Luigi della Piccola, Arthur Honegger, Francesco Malipiero, Frank Martin, Darius Milhaud and Virgil Thompson. Charles Munch had proposed that Toscanini be invited to join the board, but Nabokov refused. The good maestro has been a consistent and determined enemy of contemporary music and has at many occasions attacked its main protagonist. In early 54, the Congress set up a festival office in the noble surroundings of the Palazzo Pecci, courtesy of Count Pecci Blunt, close friend of Nabokov's, and despite his title, an American citizen. Treasurer Pierre Bonhomme organised a credit line with the Congress Chase National Bank account in Basel, through which the CIA money was funneled. Pecci Blunt made a personal contribution of $1,300, begins with D, and a further $10,000 was channeled through Denis de Rougemont's Centre Européen de la Culture, which was also receiving money directly from the Farfield Foundation and was given top billing on the programme. And arrangements were secured for the travel of Leontine Price and round-trip tickets for Aaron Copland and Michael Tippett and Josef Fuchs, I'm not sure who you are, and Ben Weber, I don't know who he is either. In March 1954, Nabokov announced the festival lineup with a heavy concentration on atonal, dodecaphonic composition. The aesthetic direction of the event pointed very much to the progressive avant-garde of Alban Berg, Elliot Carter, Luigi Della Piccola and Luigi Nono. Amongst the new composers were Peter Racine Fricker, Lou Harrison and Mario Peragallo. You'll struggle to hear any piece by those composers these days. All of whose work was influenced in varying degrees by 12-tone composition. They were, on the whole, well received. Musical America noted that most of the composers and critics making up the committees responsible for the concerts have not been known in their past for their friendliness to dodecaphonic principles or proponents. For this reason, the programs they offered here were not only surprising, but encouraging as well. A recent convert to 12-note music was Stravinsky. He wrote one serialist piece of music, and this is where it was played, this is what he wrote it for, whose presence in Rome signalled a major moment in the convergence of modernist tributaries in the serialist orthodoxy. For Nabokov, there was a clear political message in promoting music which did away with old hierarchies, and as a liberation from outdated laws about music's inner logic. Later, critics would wonder whether serialism had broken its emancipatory promise and driving music into a modernist cul-de-sac where it sat restricted and difficult, tyrannized by despotic formulae and commanding an increasingly specialized audience. Susan Sontag wrote, "Towards its squawks and thumps, we were deferential. We knew we were supposed to appreciate ugly music. We listened." Well, this is part of the thing, that you would write, you know, just low notes and high notes, but beautiful and ugly. You had the whole scale. It was part of the dogma at the time. We knew we were supposed to appreciate ugly music. We listened devoutly to the Toch, the Krennic, the Hindemith, the Webern, the Schoenberg, whatever. We had enormous appetites and strong stomachs. Perhaps sensing a challenge to his own brand of difficulty, Pierre Boulez wrote Nabokov a furious letter, larded with insults. Nabokov, he said, was encouraging a folklore of mediocrity, nurtured by petty bureaucrats, obsessed with the number 12. A council of 12? A committee of 12? A jury of 12? But who understood nothing of the creative process. Boulez went on to accuse the Congress of manipulating young composers by offering them prizes. The winners were Lou Harrison, Giselher Kleber, Jean-Louis Martinet, Mario Peragallo, and Vladimir Vogel, and you will also be challenged to hear any piece by any of those composers these days. In 1955, I was 7 years old in London. LPs arrived and Saga Records appeared, costing 10 shillings, about 70 cents, and featuring only American or British performers. I grew up listening to those LPs, so Maurice Cole playing the well-tempered clavier, and to the Fine Arts Quartet playing Beethoven Opus 131 and all six Bartok quartets. I didn't yet realise it, but by 1955, all the machinery was in place that I would get to know later when making music in London in the late 60s. Darmstadt, Tanglewood, Universal Edition, all the competitions and festivals and journals, and underlying all, post-Webern serialism. The Congress for Cultural Freedom, I wish they wouldn't do that, was dissolved in 1967 after years of leaks about its funding. By then, the CIA funding had become such public knowledge, there were dozens of articles in all sorts of magazines, that all the governing committee, resigned in a rush, pretending that they hadn't been told, and the Congress was dissolved. But Universal Edition and post-urban serialism were already in place, and they lived on. Composing is half the division of labour which defines the Western art music tradition. And nobody can survive for long with its head severed. Between them, Ongus and the Congress for Cultural Freedom severed the composing tradition of classical music and preserved classical music as a teaching and performing tradition with a static repertoire, knowing that in the recording era, a static repertoire cannot survive. There's some on your blurb there. There's some see also on ubu.com. There's a sort of website devoted to the avant-garde. They're very interesting. There's some great stuff on that. If you look up film and video, and then click on Stockhausen, one of his early Stockhausen pieces, for example, is begins with O. Forgot his name. Oh dear, oh dear. Age. check it out. I'm not saying it's not art. It's a sort of art, but it's a sort of performance art, a conceptual performance art. It has nothing to do with the tradition which was still alive in 1936 when Bartok wrote the music for strings, percussion and celeste. But it was sold to us at the time as if it was the continuation of that tradition. I'll show you, if this thing works, three photographs of some of the main protagonists. This is Tom Braden, a CIA agent, who ran the International Organizations Division, which was the nerve center of the whole soft power side of the Marshall Plan. There is also a CIA agent called Eugene Brading, and who has several pseudonyms, and it's very easy to get confused between the two. They're not the same. There's Eugene Brading, and this guy is Tom Braden. Tom Braden was a big cheese. I mean, anyone who can just hand out $500 billion in a month is a big cheese in America. They become important. There's Tom Braden, who was running the American end of the Congress for Cultural Freedom. Space down. This is a wonderful historic photograph. Michael Josselson, in the middle there, he's just seen the photographer, set up in Geneva. He lived in Geneva, in Rue Champel. And most of the inner clique of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, the musical side of it, was concentrated on Lake Geneva, Vevey in Geneva and so on, where I also lived somewhat later. And came across some of the cultural debris of this, but didn't understand it at the time. The guy on the left is John Hunt, who took over from Michael Josselson after his first heart attack, And the guy on the right, Melvin Lasky, was the sort of guy you wouldn't want to meet on a dark street. They're having a working lunch, you know, about Congress affairs, and he's just noticed the photographer too. So it's quite a brave picture. It's quite historic. This is a working lunch.
Quite a few drinks there. A liquid lunch.
Heaven knows what they were plotting. And this is, it's a bit skew-whiff. This is Michael Josselson on the left and Nicholas Nabokov in the centre, looking very aristocratic, which was his job, basically. He was mixing with the rich and powerful. And his delightful-looking wife on the right, probably about 40 or 50 years younger. And they're at the Vienna State Opera in 1957. So that's what they look like. That's Nabokov. I think Nabokov is surprisingly still alive. Was the last time I checked. Was working for one of those extreme right-wing think tanks, the Heritage Foundation or something like that. And I'm sure he's been maintained in a sufficient lifestyle. So I think that's it. That's it. What's the clock look like?
The clock looks like there's at least 7 minutes for questions. But first of all, we'll go. Thank you.